What we're dealing with here, littering air, is a complete lack of respect for the law.
And smoke in the reef.
Called the dust pop.
We live in a society of laws.
Dust pop?
Yeah. No, it's not real.
This thing of weed.
Takes one shot a weekend of training to get that bag.
Hello, ladies and gents. Welcome back to the Police Academy podcast. As promised, today we are going through this 10-page letter titled Thoughts from a Police Officer in 2020. It's 10 pages, so it covers a lot of material, a lot of ground, and it's phenomenal, to be honest. I wouldn't read a 10-page letter on the show if this officer wasn't just dead on. And everything that he says in this letter, again, covers a lot of topics and provides a lot of information to back up what he's saying. And I mean, these are the things that we should be talking about in this conversation between our law enforcement community and our society and our government, ways forward to make things better and what things actually need to be made better. You have to figure out what the actual problem is, if there is one, before you can go about fixing that. This officer does a great job of laying all that out. He sent this letter to family and friends in this time of turmoil in relation to law enforcement, and it is worth repeating here on the show for the world to hear, in my opinion, and I hope you will all agree after we're done. Don't forget that if you want to support the show, you can do so over at Patreon. That's Patreon, patreon.com. Just check out our page there, Police Academy Podcast. We have three membership levels, all the way from just wanting to support the show with a very, very minimal contribution on your part, to, you know, being as involved as possible, getting our first 50 exclusive limited edition Tumblr. There's only a few left, and whatnot. So there's all kinds of options there. Go check it out at patreon.com. The membership continues to grow, and it is awesome. So go check that out. More content for members coming soon as well. If you are a member, you should be getting this show on November 11th or 12th. So if you're not a member and you're watching or listening to this, think about how far away that date was from where you're at now. It's scheduled to be released at least, it's like a month and a half from record date. Members get everything right when it's done. Everyone else gets it when it releases on our normal schedule. So that is one aspect of our membership. So go check it out, patreon.com. Of course, Audible. I am still a member of Audible. If you love audiobooks, you should try Audible. You can try it for free. Use police promo code audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. It's a mouthful, but you can do it. audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. They send us like $15 when somebody signs up. It's free to you. You get 1 month free. And then if you like it, keep it. If you don't, cancel it. It's a win-win there for everybody. So go check that out as well. All right, let's jump into this letter. It is long, so I need to get started before I run out of time and the camera runs out of memory. So we're fighting against time here. All right, here we go. Thoughts from a police officer in 2020. I first pursued a career in law enforcement for a variety of reasons. I needed a job to support my family. I had a wife and a child to take care of, and I needed a more stable income. Law enforcement provided a steady salary, a pension, and opportunities for career advancement. Another main reason was because, as a Christian, the idea of a vocation that afforded me the opportunity to serve and love others through action attracted me to the profession. This appeals to me because it fit the call that God gave us to love others sacrificially. Police officers often respond to people experiencing the most tragic moments of their lives. What better way to demonstrate sacrificial love than to put others' lives, safety, and needs ahead of my own as a law enforcement officer? Another reason is because I thought I would be good at it. I think I generally get along with people well, for the most part, and I can resolve most issues with good old-fashioned conversation and problem-solving. However, for the time when force would be necessary to resolve the issues to protect life, liberty, and property, I felt I was well-equipped for that as well. Despite these reasons for pursuing this career, I was well aware of the climate of opinions surrounding law enforcement in the United States. The police are often perceived to be racists. They're viewed as those who act like they're above the law. People think they don't want body cameras because it incriminates their actions and words with the public. It's believed they protect each other at all costs, even if that means a deliberate avoidance to hold each other accountable. I weighed these notions carefully. I considered what others would think of this career path. I considered how this could potentially impact my relationships with my black friends, as I am white. I was afraid of what they would think of me and wondered if they thought I had somehow turned my back on them. As I wrestled with this, I confidently settled on the concept of justice. I knew that God loves justice and asks people to pursue it. Reference Psalm 33:5, Proverbs 21:15, Isaiah 1:17, Micah 6:8, Matthew 23:23, and Colossians 3:25, etc. There's many examples in the Bible. In its purest form, law enforcement is supposed to provide justice, what is right, fair, and equal for everyone. I knew that, or rather, I knew that if there was some type of culture of injustice, prejudiced, and or racist practice in a department, I would not be swayed to participate. Furthermore, I would assist in changing it if it did exist as a popular opinion seemed to suggest. And thankfully, the rigorous vetting process, written exam, polygraph, psychological evaluation, thorough background investigation, physical fitness assessment, etc., did not intimidate me because I felt that my background set me up to perform well in those areas. So I eagerly applied and was soon hired by a local police department where I lived. Since then, I have worked for two agencies in two states in completely different parts of the country. During my time, while attending two separate academies and serving two agencies and communities, I have received extensive training in diversity, de-escalation techniques, mental health awareness, etc. These are all topics that are widely viewed and communicated as subjects that somehow police officers lack proficiency in. I also find it ironic that the general public's apparently clear grasp of common sense treatment of other people that are from more diverse backgrounds is perceived to be lacking amongst law enforcement officers. I have dealt with all kinds of people of different, I have dealt with all kinds of different people, those of different age, race, gender, gender identity, sexual preference, religion, culture, physical, mental level and fitness, etc. My fellow police officers have experienced similar training and had similar encounters. With all the reports and claims of racism and excessive force practiced by police, I wanted to generally consider the question, do we have a police problem in America? I can say unequivocally that I have never personally observed an incident of racism practiced by another police officer. In two different states, in two different parts of the country, in two different departments, I have never once personally observed overt racist practices or any form of prejudice practiced by a police officer. Now, some might say it is just because I'm not good at recognizing it. They might say, since I'm white, I am not as aware. Maybe. So I ask around. No other officers I spoke to were able to point to a single incident of racism that they witnessed. These conversations included officers of different genders, sexual preferences, cultures, and races. This is not to suggest that racism, including more covert prejudice that is difficult to detect, does not exist. It does, it's wrong, it's shameful, and it needs to be confronted. When I was speaking with another black officer, he described how he is mindful of what he wears when he goes out, depending on where he is going. His wife, who is white, has learned to pick up on certain environmental signals when they're in public. She might touch his arm to let a naysayer know that her husband is with her and that everything is fine. That is real, and it's unfortunate. However, the same officer who also said, or rather, the same officer also said racism is overplayed. It's there, but it's being used for agendas. During our conversation, I recalled the amount of times I have been called a racist while performing even the most basic tasks of my job. I specifically remembered recently responding to a noise complaint. The person who answered the door was black. That person, despite me not having any idea who she was before encountering her, identified racism as the reason for our conversation. It didn't matter that I wasn't the initiator of the call for service, but only responding to a complaint. It didn't matter that I was only trying to politely request her to be mindful of her neighbors and to keep the noise down. It did not matter that I wasn't even enforcing any law. It didn't matter that I used no derogatory terms or suggestions. It did not matter that I acted as professionally as I could. It didn't matter that I was standing there with a black officer. I also remember recently arresting a white man. This individual explained that he was lucky he wasn't black because I would have shot him if he was. The suggestion that racism is overplayed is putting it lightly based on our experiences. Now, these types of encounters involving unfounded accusations of racism are almost a constant in our profession, and I can attest to that. I was the recipient of many of them as well. Continuing. But what about all these videos that clearly show the rampant racist abuse of minorities by the police? What about the evidence of widespread excessive uses of force targeting minorities? Are me and my coworkers' experiences, or no, he was correct. I should not have corrected him. He's a very good writer. Are my and my coworkers' experiences just abnormal? This isn't, after all, some funded analyzed study of a large test group or professional column that I am writing. These are just my personal experiences, thoughts, and opinions based on my involvement in a highly polarizing topic and profession. Might I be biased? Of course. You may not know my thoughts and motives in the deepest corners of my heart and mind. You should measure what I say with whatever resources and experience you have at your disposal in order to discover the truth. You can accept what I have to say or not, but this is from someone with direct, firsthand, in-the-field experience. With that in consideration, I would like to suggest that we do not have a police problem in the United States of America. We have a perspective problem. The general public has a lack of awareness when it comes to the reality of police interactions and involvement in the community. In addition, the mainstream media knows it. They use it and exploit it to get our attention. They use it as clickbait to attract more eyes, more subscriptions, more advertisements on their pages, and more money. I admit that prior to being a police officer, I would have agreed with the outrage and confusion that the general population appears to be exhibiting toward law enforcement. I would have been hashtagging Alton Sterling and Akil, apologize if I'm pronouncing that wrong, Akil Dankins, along with other notable and apparent murders by police on innocent black men. However, due to my training and experience, I recognize many of these uses of force that are labeled as excessive and unnecessary by the mainstream media and social media accounts everywhere to be, upon further examination, completely justified and reasonable, although still tragic. First, let us look at the topic of use of force in order to continue to address the idea of the problem, supposed problem, with the police. Why are many police officers being exonerated as they face charges and convictions for charges for their involvement in these controversial deaths? Is it because of a flawed and racist system? Friends in high places, lack of minority input? I believe the confusion and anger that results after these tragedies is due, at least in part, to the general public's lack of awareness regarding the legal standard by which police use of force is assessed. This legal standard is referred to as the objectively reasonable standard. My explanation of this topic is not meant to be exhaustive or comprehensive. There are other means to further explore and better familiarize oneself on this topic. This will only serve as a brief outline to provide a skeleton of understanding for the reader who is genuinely curious and maybe wonders, how someone's death can appear so obviously unjust upon its initial review, but ends with an officer not held criminally accountable or liable. The objectively reasonable standard stems from a case, Graham v. O'Connor, that looks at several factors to determine whether an officer's use of force was objectively reasonable. One factor that is considered, and I should note here, I don't know if he does further on, but the standard is whether the officer's use of force was objectively reasonable for a reasonable officer in that officer's shoes. Right, so it's, and he does touch on this a little bit, so, but that's the general standard. Has to be objectively reasonable to another officer in their shoes. All right, continuing. One factor that is considered is the severity of the crime. This factor asks questions such as, was this a property crime or was it a crime against a person? And was this a felony or was this a misdemeanor? An example of a determination of reasonableness would be if someone were shot by a police officer for vandalizing property. That would be excessive. As we consider the death of Alton Sterling, which I have covered on this show, many objectors conclude that Mr. Sterling was only selling CDs. However, when we consider what actually happened, we learn that police officers were also investigating an accusation that Mr. Sterling brandished a firearm and possibly threatened someone with it. In addition, he ultimately resisted a lawful arrest and attempted to remove a gun from his pocket during the physical altercation with officers. This was not just a minor crime, as many claimed. As a result, the officer's use of force was determined to be objectively reasonable, as it should have been. Second, the objectively reasonable standard also considers the safety of the officers and others. Some of the questions this encourages us to ask are, was there a risk of physical harm versus was there a risk of imminent serious physical harm and or death? And what would have happened if the officers didn't use the force that they used? Again, let's consider the case of Alton Sterling. The investigation revealed that Mr. Sterling was attempting to remove a firearm from his pocket. If officers didn't use deadly force, one can reasonably conclude that Mr. Sterling would have shot and murdered at least one innocent police officer. What else were the officers supposed to do? Let Mr. Sterling shoot them? I've heard it said that's what police officers sign up for. I and my fellow officers did not sign up to be murdered. We know that's a risk, and we will put our lives on the line. In fact, we do. For the safety and protection of innocent life. However, we do not have to wait for someone to pull the trigger in order to fire our weapons. No one should have that expectation placed on them, and neither should police officers. More can be said on this topic, but it's for another day. The point is, if serious bodily physical harm or death was imminent, then it's objectively reasonable to conclude that the officer's use of deadly force was appropriate. Third, the objectively reasonable standard considers whether the suspect is actively resisting versus trying to escape. For example, if someone stole a television and is simply running away with no other indication of imminently causing physical harm to anyone, it would be unreasonable to shoot that person as he or she ran away. However, if the suspect is running toward another officer with a knife in his hand, it could potentially change the level, in fact it would, of the use of force that would be considered objectively reasonable. Considering the case involving Akil Dinkins, all relevant evidence revealed that Mr. Dinkins actively resisted a lawful arrest. While doing so, he was armed with a gun and attempted to possess the officer's firearm during the physical struggle. Mr. Dinkins was not just trying to flee, he was actively resisting. Furthermore, he was actively resisting with the threat of imminent, serious physical harm or death to the officer. Therefore, it was determined that it was objectively reasonable that the officer used such a measure of force to defend himself in a way that ultimately resulted in Mr. Dinkins' death. Regardless, former professional football player Randy Moss wore a tie with Mr. Dinkins' name on it to protest against police brutality. Yes, the celebrity voicing their ignorant opinions, as usual. Continuing. Some final thoughts to conclude my discussion regarding the use of force by politicians. Jeez, I'm losing it. What page are we on? Jeez. Some final thoughts to conclude my discussion regarding the use of force by police officers, politicians. All right. First, police officers do not shoot to kill. We shoot to stop the threat. With that in mind, there are times when people describe their indignation regarding the number of shots fired at suspects in particular incidents. If an individual is shot multiple times, I often hear the argument that the suspect could have been shot once or twice, or even in the leg, so as not to kill him. However, this is not the movies. Not everyone takes a shot in the shoulder and falls down. There are four reasons, main reasons, why a suspect will stop his or her destructive behavior after being shot. Someone might stop the attack after being shot due to the pain they experience as a result. Maybe, if that's the case, an officer might be able to stop shooting after one shot, only after the threat of imminent serious physical harm or death is eliminated. The second reason is a suspect will stop the attack after being afraid, or for being afraid of being shot because of fear. Maybe he's afraid of death, pain, or disfigurement. Therefore, the attacker decides it's not worth it to continue the aggression. The third reason is if the suspect or threat is immediately neutralized because the point of contact on the suspect shuts down his or her central nervous system, i.e. a headshot, central, a spinal shot that shuts the body down, etc. That's basically it. You got to take out the nervous system. The final reason a suspect will stop attacking is simply because the amount of blood loss renders him or her unable to continue, which is the primary reason, the most likely way an attack, a violent, deadly force attack will stop is by blood loss. It can potentially take a long time for someone to lose blood from being shot, depending on a variety of factors, including suspect's level of commitment to his act of violence, the severity of the suspect's wounds from the rounds that pierced their body, whether he or she has some type of drug that allows a physiological and or psychological method for continuing to fight despite the damage to the body, like PCP, etc. Again, this is not the movies. Not everyone stops performing violent acts because they get shot. In fact, most people don't. Therefore, it might take several shots or more to stop a threat if that particular suspect requires a loss of blood to prevent him from continuing his act of aggression. I also want to briefly address the often mentioned shoot them in the leg idea rather than shooting vital organs. Recently, former vice president and current presidential candidate Joe Biden at this time, he is still a presidential candidate. He has not been confirmed other than by mainstream media outlets, which no one trusts at this point. But Joe Biden stated, instead of standing there and teaching a cop, I wish I could do a Joe Biden impression. I haven't practiced it, so I won't try. Instead of standing there and teaching a cop when there's an unarmed person coming at them with a knife or something, shoot them in the leg instead of in the heart. End quote. That's a quote from Joe Biden. Tragically enough, I can't spend too much time on this since it is not the focal point of why I'm writing this, but there are so many inaccuracies in that one statement that I have to address it for at least a moment. Plus, it is indicative of the widespread ignorance from the general population regarding police tactics and use of force. First, a knife can be, and it is, an extremely deadly weapon. Second, someone suggesting an officer should shoot a small and dynamically moving part, especially in an incident under the stress of imminent serious physical harm or death, containing extreme time limitations in a fast, tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving situation before such harm or death will occur, is obviously unfamiliar with firearms and most likely never have been involved or has never been involved in a legitimate physical altercation. Again, there is a lot more to discuss, but I cannot delve into every facet of this complex and broad issue that I'm writing about. For more information about knife attacks, Google 21-foot rule in law enforcement. You can also read a little more about why officers are trained to aim and shoot at center mass rather than head, arm, leg, etc. Additionally, you can find out more about how it is objectively reasonable in some cases necessary, for a suspect to be shot in the back. As I would love to discuss that more, That is a discussion for another day, but the shot in the back comment, I would refer everyone to the Rashard Brooks, a justified shooting when the officers did in fact shoot him in the back. Finally, on what page am I on? I must check. Wow, I'm on page 5. We're halfway there. Great article though. So we are going to finish this Mamma Jamma. All right, now I just lost my page. What page did I say? Page 5. Stand by. I jumped to page 8. We cannot have this. All right, here we go. Back on track. Page 5. Finally, on the topic of use of force, the reasonableness of an officer's use of force is judged from the perspective, I knew he got to this eventually, of a reasonable officer, not from the perspective of an untrained civilian. In addition, when judging use of force from the perspective of a reasonable officer, it should be considered that the use of force may have occurred during a fast, tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving situation. These are critical and necessary elements to consider for an accurate determination regarding the reasonableness of an officer's use of force. Why? For the same reason that I am not in an advisory position that oversees an officer's... For the same reason that I am not in an advisory position that oversees the effectiveness of NASA. Probably because I have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to that particular subject matter. No matter how much I think I know, what movies I've seen or what space books I've read to my kids, don't lie, you read them for yourself. It's not for the kids. I have not had the appropriate training to be in that role. In the same way, the pervasive and trendy idea that untrained civilians are capable of appropriately evaluating officers' use of force is as equally impractical and, I will add, as the host, idiotic. Joe Biden's recent statements, speak of the devil, that I mentioned earlier prove that even respected and widely regarded logical leaders and thinkers cannot accurately evaluate law enforcement unless they are specifically and specially trained to do so. This is not to say that only police officers should be the ones to formally evaluate uses of force. This is simply to suggest that only trained individuals should, and that uses of force must be properly evaluated from the perspective of a reasonable officer. In conclusion on this point, and to reiterate, I believe one of the main reasons why there is a disconnect between the public and police is due to the general population's lack of knowledge and perspective into law enforcement. However, this is not the only reason. There's also a lack of awareness from the general public regarding the simple realities of what relevant research determines on the topic. For example, in a recent study conducted by Washington State University researcher Dr. Lois James, it was determined that police officers were less likely to shoot unarmed black suspects than unarmed white or Hispanic ones. Reference Journal of Experimental Criminology. In addition, Harvard University professor Roland Fryer analyzed over 1,000 police-involved shootings that occurred across the country. He concluded there is zero evidence of racial bias in police shootings. In Houston, he determined black suspects were 24% less likely than white suspects to be shot by police, even though the suspects were armed or violent. An analysis of a Washington Post police shooting database and federal crime statistics reveals that 12% of all whites slash Hispanics that die from homicide are killed by police officers. In contrast, only 4% of blacks that die as victims of homicide are killed by police. In addition, based on the data that I have been able to locate, 9 unarmed black men were killed by police last year. The term unarmed, is in quotes, is loosely applied, as it does not describe in detail incidents involving knives, reaching for a gun, attempting to remove weapons from an officer's belt, etc. What he's getting at here is that of those 9 unarmed killings of black men by police officers, many of them included situations where, had the deadly force not been used, that suspect would have become armed and probably killed a police officer. If someone is trying to take your gun, i.e. Michael Brown, Ferguson, Missouri, and you stop them using deadly force from doing so, they will be classified as unarmed in this situation under the Washington Washington Post guidelines, or however they classifications. But they were only unarmed because they didn't succeed in arming themselves. So it's a bit misleading. Continuing, only two of those nine officers were convicted of crimes as a result of those uses of force. In 2019, police shot and killed 55 unarmed suspects. 14 of those were black and 25 were white. And that's according to the Washington Post Fatal Force Database. According to a Bureau of Justice Statistics special report, only 2% of all citizens contacted by police experienced force or even the threat of force. Despite this, the New York Times wrote in an editorial justifying the Ferguson riots, again, Michael Brown, quote, "The killing of young black men by police is a common feature of American life and a source of dread for black parents from coast to coast," end quote. This is simply not true. In Heather McDonald's book, The War on Cops, she details how officers are slowing their proactive approach to law enforcement thanks to the false narrative that police culture is infected by racial and homicidal bias. At the time, we were referring to this as the Ferguson effect, and it definitely is a thing. Police are essentially forced to only be reactive, to only respond after a crime was committed. Officers are forced to do this because a proactive method of policing has been largely labeled as racist. This is what organizations like the ACLU, politicians, and now it appears the general population are asking them to do. Officers only enforce whatever society determines is reasonable for them to enforce. If society as a whole refuses police practice and presence, that is how the police respond. Police officers are servants of the community. We do what society expects of us. Currently, the desire and expectation from many communities, or at least the perceived desire and expectation, is to leave them alone, all because of the myth that police officers across America are racists. Not only are police avoiding being proactive as a result of societal demand, they're also afraid of losing their jobs, being arrested, losing qualified immunity, and being socially crucified. See the incident involving Rashard Brooks' death as a result of objectively reasonable uses of force by police officers that resulted in loss of jobs and arrests. In addition, the unwarranted societal backlash against the police has led many good officers leaving law enforcement to pursue other career options. The result of all of this, unsurprisingly and unfortunately, more violent crime. According to Michael Snyder in the blog Economic Collapse, at least 41 people were hit by gunfire in New York City over 4th of July weekend. According to NYPD's figures, at approximately halfway through the year, murders are up 23%, shooting victims are up 51%, burglaries up 119%, and car thefts up 48% compared to 2019. Now, this is happening nationwide, not just in New York City. In Chicago, at least 67 people were hit by gunfire over the holiday weekend. Nine of them were children. And there are much more dangerous weekends that happened in Chicago recently. There was a weekend where we had over 100 people shot and, countless people killed by, it wasn't by the police, right? So, in Philadelphia, shootings are up 67%. Victims of armed violence are up 29%. Homicides, 25%. CBS New York reported on July 14th that shootings jumped up 277% last week compared to the same time last year. 67 victims compared to only 17 the prior year. According to the New York Post, 503 police officers in New York City have recently filed for retirement. They weren't fired, they retired since May 25, 2020. 503 police officers filed for retirement. This is a 75% increase over the same time period compared to 2019. As reported on July 7, 2020, 179 have filed for retirement the past week compared to 39 the same time period before in 2019. That's a 411% increase. Now, the city is begging police to delay retirement to deal with the increase in crime. Now, if what I have said so far is the reality, how does this misinformation become so widely accepted? Why have so many of the general public adopted these lies about the police? This leads me to my final point. While addressing the major problems regarding the fractioned relationship between the police and the public, the media. There was a time when professional journalism was trusted. There was a time when my parents would turn on the news and listen to reporters provide relatively unbiased information about the facts of the day. They read the morning paper to catch up on accurate summaries of current events. They would generally accept and trust the information they received with little criticism needed to distinguish the reality of the information they received. It's been a long day. Those days are gone. We don't have to find news because the news finds us in all forms and from all angles. Professionalism and accuracy have been replaced with sensationalism. Writers, professional and amateur, seem to spend more time on the titles of their articles than the accuracy of their content. They ask themselves, how can I get someone to click this link? How can I get them to subscribe? How can I make a name for myself and catapult my career? How can we make money off of this? How can I push the narrative that satisfies the goal of the agenda? They begin to write. Another white police officer kills another black man. Each word in that sentence is triggering. Does the true story even matter at that point? Does it matter whether or not the use of force was justified and necessary? And even if it wasn't a reasonable use of force, is there any evidence that it was racially motivated? It doesn't matter to them. The damage has already been done before the story is even told. Time and time again, stories are introduced in that manner, regardless of the reality of the unfortunate event. Then perhaps a well-meaning celebrity desires to use his or her platform to cast attention on the perceived racially biased injustice executed on an innocent minority. Momentum snowballs. Social media accounts erupt with activity demanding justice and hashtags of the unfortunate soul's name. Then something happens again 3 days later. It involved another white officer and another black person. The same words are used to introduce and describe this most recent story. It doesn't matter that this particular incident involves a completely different set of circumstances, in a completely different department, in a completely different state, in a completely different part of the country involving completely different people. How does this same thing keep happening over and over again? People ask themselves, frustrated and confused. For example, a recent death of a black man named David McAtee, probably saying that wrong, my bad, in Louisville attracted the attention of professional football player Miles Garrett. Garrett, prior to the investigation being even close to complete, deemed the actions of the officers, quote-unquote, despicable. Video of the incident later became available, and at least at this point in the investigation, which is ongoing, it indicated that Mr. McAtee, fired the initial shot. Police appeared to take cover and return fire. Garrett also criticized police for leaving the suspect's body on scene for too long, with no apparent understanding that certain crime scenes can take a long time to process in order for an accurate investigation to be completed and justice to be appropriately administered. Same thing happened with Michael Brown. Now, could this incident result in the investigation determining there was misconduct practiced by police that warrants such comments by Garrett? Maybe, although that doesn't appear to be the case at this point. But his comments reveal a larger and troubling trend. People jumping to the conclusion that there was not only police misconduct, but that the misconduct was also somehow racially motivated. Mainstream media, in my opinion, is most at fault for these trends. Their repeated, irresponsible, agenda-driven, inaccurate, and misleading reports have blinded well-intentioned people. These misguided yet well-intentioned people have now drawn unnecessary lines in the sand, and now almost everything is polarized. Politics, pandemics, race, religion, police. Not only this, they ignore the numbers and incidents of police shootings involving white suspects because it does not fit their narratives and agendas. I know of an incident involving a 50-year-old white male domestic violence suspect from Alabama that charged an officer while holding a spoon. I'm also familiar with a 21-year-old white male robbery suspect in Ohio that didn't remove his hands from his waist when police commanded him to. Both suspects were killed by police. Yet there was almost no coverage for these incidents or a number of incidents like them. Video of Daniel Shaver's death, for another example. That's one that we've done on this show as well. If those individuals were black, it would undoubtedly be used by the media as propaganda or copaganda, as it's now being called by those who see through the veil of hidden interests. Let's also consider Minneapolis. With the recent incident involving the unjust actions of police involving the death of George Floyd, everyone, including police everywhere, denounced such practice. But was it racist? The investigation could reveal that it was. However, why do we assume that it was? And why, just several years prior in Minneapolis, when a black police officer unreasonably shot and killed a white woman, was race as a motive not assumed? Both incidents appear to be the result of actions that any police officer would describe as unacceptable, but the incidents are completely regarded as distinguishable according to the media coverage they received. According to the Crime Prevention Research Center, black officers are no less likely to shoot suspects than white officers. Despite this notion, all police shootings from 2013 to 2015, on all police shootings from that time frame, local news coverage involving a black officer shooting a black suspect was covered by national media only 9% of the time. In contrast, when a white police officer officer shot a black suspect, it was covered nationally 38% of the time. The media has little regard for the truth or the consequences of their reckless methods and does not care about the division it causes our country. The media is biased, not the police. At one point in my career, the Black Lives Matter movement was near its origin. It had just started to gain momentum. After a period I'm sorry, people. I have been on Microsoft Teams all day long, and my brain is complete mush right now. If you notice that little glitch in the video earlier, it's because my camera, as I mentioned at the beginning, did run out of memory, and it set me back a few hours, because by the time I got everything back up and running, I was back on Microsoft Teams for some just high-quality distance learning, courtesy of the United States Army, and now here we are, several hours later. Anyways, at one point in my career, we'll just start back at the beginning of this paragraph, the Black Lives Matter movement was near its origin. It had just started to gain momentum after a perceived unjust death of a minority. One of my colleagues suggested the BLM group was a bad organization. I jumped in to defend the basic premise of the Black Lives Matter mission and tried to make him realize they were just fighting for equality and against racial injustice. I did not believe this colleague was making his statements out of racist motives or ideologies. His wife is black, and I know him to be a man of integrity. He explained to me they weren't fighting for justice because they were fighting against police officers who used justified and reasonable uses of force. Now, my interaction with him was brief, but I figured I should look into the Black Lives Matter group a little closer. So I did. What I found were people under the Black Lives Matter banner defending people like Alton Sterling, Akil Dinkins, Dante Parker, Sean Reed, or any number of incidents that resulted in the tragic deaths of individuals due to their own criminal actions. BLM's outline for change sounded just, but their message cultivated blindly supporting someone because he or she was a minority who died while dealing with the police. Regardless of the circumstances, people were protesting legitimate police actions used to apprehend dangerous and violent criminals. BLM's stance appeared to be as follows. If you're a police officer, what you do is wrong, no matter what. If you're a minority, what you do is right, no matter what. I was disappointed at my findings. I was also embarrassed that I defended a group who claims justice as its mantra, but acts in direct opposition to that mantra. Now, I apologize to my colleague. However, I don't think the BLM movement is too far off the mark all the time. They need to stop grouping all deaths of minorities connected with police contact as unreasonable. Each incident needs to be accurately assessed on a case-by-case basis. Anything less is just prejudiced, and that is exactly what they are claiming to be against. If they focused on the incidents and social structures that actually need attention and change, their cause would make more sense. Widespread police brutality does not need that attention because widespread police brutality does not exist in America. Ultimately, I think it is just a misled group that lacks clarity of vision and strong leadership. According to the NYPD, 90% of shooting victims in New York City in the month of June were minorities. As reported on July 7, 2020, homicides rose 83% over a 28-day period when compared to the same 28-day period prior in 2019. An 83% rise in murders. Almost all of them were deaths of minorities. Remember all of the statistics mentioned earlier regarding the rise in crime? The vast majority of those victims, particularly of violent crimes, were minorities too. This is undoubtedly due, at least in part, if not in whole, to the societal backlash against the police. Criminals know that they are in control. Do these Black Lives Matter to Black Lives Matter? Do all Black Lives Matter to Black Lives Matter? I'll answer that right now. No, they're very clear that they don't care about all Black Lives. They care about only the ones that they put on their posters at their protests. Their attitude appears to communicate, never mind all the people dying from violence involving real minority victims, we have a false narrative and agenda to promote. Is this the America that society now wants? This isn't the America that police officers want. As Heather McDonald explains in her book, The War on Cops, there is no governmental organization more committed to the concept of Black Lives Matter than the police. I would also add that there is no Christian or religious organization more committed to justice for African Americans than the police. The result of this rampant spread of misinformation is genuine fear. I don't blame John Wall, a professional basketball player, for saying, quote, "If I get pulled over right now, I'm terrified. To be realistic, if I'm in a dark area or a back street, I'm not stopping. I'll go on a high-speed chase to get to a spot where it's a grocery store or somewhere where there's a lot of lights at, because that's how terrifying it is," end quote. Why wouldn't he think that based on the information being communicated to him and everyone else? I see this type of fear all the time when I initiate a traffic stop with someone Black inside the car. They're scared. I do everything I can to alleviate their concern, but they are terrified. I can't exactly hand them this paper during our brief encounters to ease their discomfort. Despite the reality that a Black man is more likely to be killed by lightning than a police officer, LeBron James tweeted, quote, "We're literally hunted every day, every time we step foot outside the comfort of our homes," end quote. Perception is reality, and unfortunately, this is the reality that African Americans and law enforcement must deal with in our interactions with one another until truth becomes more widely accepted. Actual typo there. I trust it. He's such a good writer. I finally trusted his writing and went with two, and it was wrong. Man, just right when I started to really think he had this all squared away. Until the truth becomes more widely accepted. All right, continuing. Let's consider for a moment what police officers deal with on a regular basis. We provide CPR to those on the brink of death. Sometimes, unfortunately, even children. We deal with women so trapped in battered relationships that they post bond for the men that almost killed them. We deal with sexual assaults, child abuse, suicides, horrific crashes, death notifications, hoarders, grabbing people with infectious diseases, open sores, and more. We do this regularly, all the time. In addition, there is a constant awareness that the next call could be our last. We are aware that most people we arrest can generally get along and in and amongst the rest of society. Maybe they just made a mistake or fell into an addiction that led to other criminal activity. However, we are also aware that there are people, for whatever reason, mental health, greed, sociopathic tendencies, just plain evil, etc., that will not hesitate to kill another person. We are required to deal with such individuals. Let's also consider who police officers are. We're just normal people. We have families, we have children, we have mortgages, we have friends, we watch TV, we watch movies, our kids play sports. We are members of society just like everyone else. However, our jobs come with tremendous authority, the ability to take freedom away. And we do this covered in protective gear, weaponry, and a badge. Because of this, it is easy to dehumanize the police. It's easy to blame the authority for everything because that authority is viewed as a faceless stormtrooper rather than a neighbor or a friend. Regardless, I want you to just consider why. Why would someone, any sane person that has to deal with all the nonsense that society has to offer on a regular basis, want to put him or herself in a position to unlawfully detain, arrest, assault, or kill someone that could result in the loss of their careers, their families, their finances, their freedom, and their lives? Why would someone do that willingly? Do you really believe there are a lot of officers that would do that because they don't like someone else that has a different skin color? It just doesn't make sense. I know you could say racism doesn't make sense, but it still exists. That's accurate. But do you really believe something as irrational and immoral as racism is as pervasive in one particular profession as it's being made out to be? Why would that be true? How does that make sense? Would your neighbor want to go into work thinking that he wants to get into a gunfight today? Would your friend go to work thinking he wants to pick on someone because of their skin color? Of course not. We don't want to either. I'm here to tell you that the accusation of widespread police brutality and racism is completely false. I hope for some you realize you've been largely duped. It will take humility and soul searching to change your opinion, but I hope you can summon the courage. Now, despite the growing opinion that police cause more harm than good, the thin blue line tag that is often used to describe the separation between order and chaos in society is accurate. All one needs to do is look at other countries with real, widespread turmoil and corruption in law enforcement and government. Plenty of countries have laws. They just don't have the appropriate method of enforcing them ethically and equitably. Those that are making proposals such as defunding or even disbanding the police are doing so out of the abundance of freedom and protection afforded to them by the people they are claiming to be against. What we need in our society for this alleged problem with police in America is not police reform. It's not defunding police or even more radicalized notions suggested by Minneapolis government officials to disband police. It's not more cultural sensitivity training, de-escalation training, etc. The police problem in America is not the police. Are there mistakes made? Yes. Do the nature of the seriousness of incidents that police respond to, back up, due to the nature of the seriousness of incidents that police respond to, those mistakes are magnified in their consequences. Are there officers that have no business being in law enforcement? Yes, but that is no different than any other profession. Teachers, doctors, lawyers, etc. Does law enforcement have an ugly history of racist practices? Yes, but so does virtually every profession in our country. Right now, people are trying to fight racism with more prejudice. They think that judging people by the color of their uniforms will put an end to judgment of one's skin color. One might say, now you know how it feels. True. However, that does not justify it. We can't fight racism with more prejudice. Until the general public becomes more informed regarding police practice by doing ride-alongs, participating in citizen police academies, and looking into the realities of police conduct, this will not change. Furthermore, the voice of the culture with anti-police sentiments is so loud, aggressive, divisive, and damning that if anyone disagrees or points out the shortcoming of their points, they are socially crucified, cast out, lose their jobs, and labeled as racists. This cancel culture is very real and powerful. Therefore, people with opposing views remain silent. Police officers can't speak out. Social media represents, by and large, one viewpoint. Politicians pander to loud voices. We live in a society that essentially says, unless you admit you're a racist, you're a racist. So the silence remains deafening. One thing the reader might ask is, what is the media's alleged agenda that you keep pointing out? I'm intentionally not diving into that here, along with many other topics that I would like to bring up and discuss, such as California's recent proposal to change the objectively reasonable standard to a necessary standard, the recent discussion regarding law enforcement, qualified immunity, tactics versus use of force, body cameras, citizen complaints, the use of tasers, law enforcement response to people with mental health issues, etc. However, this has largely gone... However, this has already gone on longer than I wanted. It's the theme of the day. Regardless, there are still more conversations to be had to potentially repair community relationships with the police. In conclusion, unless we focus on the issues mentioned earlier, lack of understanding in regards to the objectively reasonable standard of use of force, a lack of understanding of the reality of what the research indicates regarding race relations between police and minorities, and the widespread exploitation and misinformation from the media as it relates to community and police relationships, I do not see this repair happening anytime soon. That's the end of the letter. 10 pages. I got halfway through. My camera ran out of battery. And then I had to go back into the purgatory that is Microsoft Teams distance learning in the Army. So I apologize for my missteps in reading this. I hope it doesn't take away from what this officer is saying here, because he's dead on. Very well written. So many great points being made in this letter. And I think he's definitely pointing in the general right direction as far as what the issue is. Why are we so divided? Why are people so angry? How did we get to where we are? The media has fanned the flames of this narrative so heavily that it's gained a momentum that seems impossible to stop. I don't think anything's impossible, but right now, it does seem that more and more Americans are starting to believe these, I'll call them lies. This officer thinks they're lies. I think they're lies, because we're looking at the data. And on top of that, we have actual experience in law enforcement. We've worked with these officers that everyone's saying are racist. We've worked in the system everyone is saying is systemically and pervasively racist. And we're not seeing it, right? I mean, I too have never seen an officer deal with someone, treat someone negatively because of their race or ethnic background. I just... again, you can always say, well, you just don't pay attention to these things. I'm a pretty intuitive person. I think I would know, especially with how closely you work with your fellow officers. I mean, you're out there every day on calls with these same people. You're going to know. I mean, you're going to pick up on these things. You know when an officer is just being a dick, just to be a dick, right? And officers sometimes are. It might just be because they're having a bad day, right? But you know if it was based on race, because you've seen them have a bad day with white women, suburban women, right? And also with minorities. So I'm with this officer. I don't see the, I have not in my own personal law enforcement experience seen any of this alleged racism from police officers. The statistics don't back it up, but the media continues to push this narrative so hard that people have come to just assume it's true. And I don't know. I don't know where that ends, how we stop it, and how we change it. I don't know how we get people to invest the time into understanding law enforcement issues well enough to be able to actually have an informed opinion on these things. As he mentions, people watch a video. LeBron James watches a video and starts making statements about police officers, broadly speaking, based on one incident. There's many issues there. First of all, number one, that's one officer dealing with one suspect. And if that officer screwed up, that's on that officer. It's not on every other officer out there. But number two, he doesn't even know if what the officer did was wrong because he's a basketball player. What makes his opinion valuable? Nothing. LeBron James is an idiot. I've heard the comments that he said about the police. The guy's a moron. He has no idea what he's talking about. And I know that'll piss some people off because I'm sitting here, I'm a white guy, be like, well, how can you say he doesn't know what he's talking about? You're white. You don't know what he's talking about. What he's talking about when it comes to police actively hunting down blacks in America is patently false. We would see that in the statistics. It's not there. It's a lie. And you have to be an idiot to believe that. And say that out loud with a platform like he has. It's irresponsible. And it pisses us off as police officers because we know it's not true, but we don't have the voice that LeBron James has. Yeah, he's a great basketball player, but man, don't get me started on this one. I mean, the idea that celebrities' opinions on political issues, societal issues matters at all is so preposterous, but it's so widespread. He's good at basketball. Why is his opinion on police issues relevant? It doesn't make any sense. And that's where we really come down to. None of this makes any sense. I will point out, when he talks about not to criticize this officer's thoughts on this, not at all. I think just to have the discussion, when he talks about Black Lives Matter being poorly led and misguided, kind of like meandering kind of organization or movement, I tend to disagree with that. From what I know of Black Lives Matter, they actually are very well, it is a very effective organization, whether it's well led or not. It's got kind of they purport themselves to be a very diffused organization, non-centralized organization. However, I do think that they are very intentional in their messaging, that they are not misguided, that Black Lives Matter has a very specific agenda, and they are taking the actions and having the effects that they need to realize that agenda right now. And that's what makes them so dangerous. They look like this disorganized, just kind of movement, but the reality is that Black Lives Matter is a very laser-focused organization on what their agenda is, and that is essentially destroying the United States of America as it exists today. Not to destroy the country physically, but to remove the the entire structure of our country as it stands. And that's a terrifying thing. If you understand what our country is and what it was designed to be, granted that we never reach the ideals that we strive to, if you understand what our Constitution is, then that's terrifying. All right. I've been going on long enough. My brain is almost complete mush right now. I've got just enough to be able to actually make words. So I'm going to wrap this one up. If you have stuck this one out, thank you so much for listening. I'm sure many of you had because, I mean, this was a great letter from this officer. Thanks. Huge shout out to the officer who wrote this. Thank you for taking the time, not only for your friends and family, but to send it, to be brave enough to send this to us and have an idiot like me read this live to the entire world. Literally, we have listeners from all over the world. It goes on YouTube as well. So who knows who might be listening, watching this. But this is what police officers are saying. Every time I get a letter from an officer, it almost without fail, it lines up directly with my sense of things on these topics. And I get a lot more that are just saying, hey, thank you for speaking for us. You're dead on. We love what you're doing. Keep going. Right. So I know that, not to pat myself on the back, but just understand that what I'm putting out here on the show, what this officer is saying, does represent law enforcement in general in our country. You don't really hear it because, again, the mainstream media doesn't cover it, and cops don't want to talk about it. They don't want to go on CNN or talk to the New York Times or go on Fox or any of these mainstream media outlets because they know that what they have to say is not what those outlets want to hear, and they're not going to be portrayed as in a fair light. Let's put it that way. When the New York Times reached out to us and said, hey, we want someone to comment on George Floyd, on what's going on in law enforcement today in the United States. And I said, hell yeah, let's do it. Well, I haven't been on the New York Times yet, right? Because they no doubt do a little bit of research before they bring people onto their platforms. And I'm sure they heard enough, especially recently from me, that they said, there's no way we're letting that guy on the air. Because I've listened to their show. It's called The Daily. I've never heard a single person on The Daily represent law enforcement in a real way. Because that's not the narrative they want to build. That's not the content that they want. So anyways, that's the goal of these letters. That's the goal, right? My near-term goal with the show is to correctly and accurately represent the police officers in America specifically, but police officers in general, who really do go out there every single day, stick their necks out for the people who more and more so today are trying to crucify them at every given chance. And that's a really tough place to be, and they need a voice. So that's what we're doing here. Thank you all again for sticking around. We love you guys. Please go check out Patreon if you're not interested in any of the stuff that we have to offer for our members. At the very least, our minimum level membership is something that you'll never notice in your monthly budget, but it'll have a huge impact here for us in being able to do more and reach more people. So we appreciate that. And again, huge shout out to our members as well, who are helping make this show, helping it to continue on and make it even better, and engaging in conversations with each other and with me. So love you all, and we'll see you all next time. As always, do good, be strong, stay free.